Hello, today is Wednesday, February 18th, 2026. My name is Elizabeth Ingber with the Talking Information Center. This is the New York Times. The Epstein Files. The Price of Admission to Epstein's World. Silence. There were plenty of signs that something was not right with Jeffrey Epstein. Why Didn't Anyone Say Something? By Lisa Miller. When Jeffrey Epstein said massage in the years after he got out of jail in 2009, what did his friends and associates think he meant? Epstein had been convicted in a Florida court of sex crimes with minors in 2008. His method, reported in the New York Times at the time, had been to recruit girls as young as 14 to his home and persuade them to undress and massage him. Then he would force them to have sex and paid them cash. He was charged with sex crimes again in 2019, this time by the federal government, which accused him of trafficking underage girls in the early 2000s. If he committed crimes in the years between 2009 and his death in a Manhattan jail cell while awaiting federal trial in 2019, he was not charged with them. But the Epstein files show that, during that decade, he was both rebuilding and curating his vast elite social network, while also looking at plans for a new massage room on his private island of Little St. James and choosing marble for his massage room in New York. At the same time, he was vetting young women from all over the world for their sexual attractiveness, ranking their attributes, soliciting sex, and enlisting them into his service. Very beautiful, fresh, one scout wrote to Epstein in 2011 of a 21-year-old woman about 5 feet 8 inches tall. Nice girl, but almost no English at all. The same scout wrote of another, who was 22, that Epstein was a registered sex offender in New York and Florida was a matter of record, that he usually traveled with an entourage of girls. In his correspondence, he also called them assistants or students, was common knowledge. Richard Branson called this entourage Epstein's harem. As long as you bring your harem, Branson wrote in 2013. A representative for Branson has said that he met with Epstein only a few times in business settings and that he saw him only with adult women. Branson considers Epstein's actions abhorrent, the representative said. At least some of Epstein's friends knew what he meant when he said massage. In 2010, in an email to Boris Nikolic, then the science advisor to the Gates Foundation, Epstein said he was finishing one. "With happy ending, I hope," Nikolic responded, punctuating his note with a winking emoji. Nikolic did not respond to a request for comment. "I'm too impatient, happy beginning," Epstein replied, with characteristically haphazard punctuation. The emails also show Epstein organizing massages for friends and connecting friends with women as favors or gifts. When in 2017 Deepak Chopra complained of a crazy day, Epstein replied, "I'm in Florida and would like to send two girls. I am deeply saddened by the suffering of the victims in this case," wrote Chopra in a statement earlier this month. Catherine Ruemmler, former White House counsel under President Obama, implicitly acknowledged she knew the difference between a massage and what Epstein engaged in, referring to it in an email as "your kind of massage." She also knew Epstein's history. He sometimes sought her legal advice, and in 2015, she pointed out to him, clearly, that a minor could not legally consent to engaging in prostitution. But in 2017, Epstein was accompanying her as she looked at apartments. On February 3rd, she said through a representative, "I had no knowledge of any ongoing criminal conduct on his part, and I did not know him as the monster he has been revealed to be." On Thursday, she resigned from Goldman Sachs, where she was the firm's top lawyer. Even in a world where a president can receive oral sex from an intern, lie about it, get impeached, and remain in office, where a candidate for president can be heard saying that he can grab women by the expletive without fear of reprisal and get elected twice, Epstein's social prominence is astonishing. It shows how a group can collude with dark secrets if they are sufficiently ambiguous and serve their interests. At least one friend warned Epstein of possible reputational damage from his behavior with women. His conviction had been public, after all, and could be interpreted, indeed was, as a powerful man taking advantage of powerless young women, the friend wrote. The person's name was redacted. What's most shocking is that no one said anything. How is it that the girls, as Epstein called them, their presence, their provenance, their role, failed to raise misgivings among the quietest whisper among the super powerful men and women who dined at Epstein's table? The list of bold-faced names availing themselves of Epstein's hospitality is by now familiar. Elon Musk, Steve Bannon, Peter Attia. Guests like these exist within their own galaxies of assistants, advisors, and hangers-on. Is it possible that no one raised questions about Epstein's treatment of women beyond a certain coy or coded admiration for what they saw as his extravagant taste? His lifestyle is very different and kind of intriguing, although it would not work for me, Gates wrote to colleagues in 2011 after a visit with Epstein. Gates has called his relationship with Epstein a big mistake and denied Epstein's claim in a draft email that Gates engaged in extramarital sex. In an interview with Die Zeit on February 12th, the cognitive scientist, Jascha Bock, acknowledged that Epstein's relationship to women in his environment, especially some of his employees, seemed unfriendly at times and disrespectful. In a separate email to the New York Times, Bock added that he had some conversations with Epstein's assistants, in which I inquired about their well-being. He added, "Nothing they told me or what I observed gave reason for concern that anything coercive or illegal could be going on." Tessa West, a professor of social psychology at New York University, describes the collective silence around Epstein and his girls as willful inaction. Even if the guests at Epstein's table were not engaging in illegal or harmful behavior, some had to have seen red flags, and they are doing nothing about it. They are not saying anything. They are not discouraging it, West said. Given what she knows about gender dynamics in her profession, academia, I am zero surprised by any of this, she said. Scientists like West offer clues to why and how Epstein's world functioned to protect him. Social psychologists describe Epstein's world as an in-group, upgraded by optimal distinctiveness. Distinctiveness conveys exclusiveness, and Epstein was the man at the velvet rope, choosing those who were in. Guests at his table had to be interesting, vogue-ish, powerful or useful enough. The girls were ranked on a scale. 10, expletive, he said of a woman whom he had connected with Steve Tisch, chairman of the New York Giants. Tisch has said he regretted what he said was his brief relationship with Epstein and that the women they had discussed were adults. The exclusivity had a multiplying effect. The more top-notch the company, the more people wanted in. And Epstein had a lot to offer, West pointed out. Soft power, opportunity, financial opportunity, social connection, she said. And crucially, for the professors and university presidents knocking at his door, money in a world where academics don't have any. Some of the girls saw Epstein as an opportunity, too. He sent them to Frederick Fekai for haircuts and referred them to plastic surgeons. He will send you to his partner that takes fat from your expletive and puts it in your breasts, he wrote to one. He sent them to the doctor and seems to have paid for school, including, apparently, massage lessons. The gatherings, the properties, the amenities were all designed to seduce and astonish. At the compound on Little St. James, the food was better than any we've had at the Ritz. Ellis Rubinstein, then the president of the New York Academy of Sciences, wrote to a friend. He went there with his kids. Rubinstein did not respond to requests for comment. The French orchestral conductor, Frédéric Chaslin, was entranced by a visit to Epstein's Santa Fe ranch. There is something totally voluptuous about all that I saw. I was feeling drunk from the beginning to the end, without a drop of alcohol, like being inside a work of art, he wrote to Epstein in a thank you note. Earlier this month, Cheslin issued a statement. Any implication that he did wrong is based on isolated sentences, out of context, and loaded with intentions they never had, he said. I formally refute these hints. The girls were in attendance at dinner parties and on the plane. Leslie Groff, Epstein's executive assistant, booked multiple hotel rooms when Epstein traveled. Regarding the two-bedroom suite, do the bedrooms each have king-size beds? She asked Thomas Pritzker's assistant. Pritzker is the executive chairman of Hyatt Hotels Corporation, and he apparently helped Epstein with rooms. Two double beds? Groff asked. Or what is the arrangement there? On Tuesday, Pritzker resigned as Hyatt's executive chairman, saying he exercised terrible judgment in staying in contact with Epstein and Ghislaine Maxwell. Self-interest would have prompted his guests and visitors to look away, West said, and Epstein's coded, euphemistic language gave them cover. Unless incontrovertible evidence of a renewed sex trafficking operation was literally in your face, the provenance of the girls and their role could have been downgraded to an uneasy feeling or a rumor, West explained. Any time there is sufficient ambiguity in the behavior of a person, we are motivated to see it in a way that benefits us, she explained. Perhaps that is why the paleontologist, Jack Horner, the winner of the MacArthur Foundation's so-called Genius Fellowship, could assert in his apology earlier this month that when he visited Epstein at his Santa Fe ranch in 2012 and was introduced to four college students, two of whom claimed to be adept in genetics, he saw nothing weird, inappropriate, or out of the ordinary. He added, I now understand the students may have been victims of Epstein, and I deeply regret that I did not realize this. In his thank you note at the time, Horner wrote, I had a great time, especially spending time with you and the girls, and seeing your Cretaceous sediments and the old railroad. He signed off, Please give all the girls my very best wishes, and to you, whom I envy. In 2012, experiments by the Dutch social psychologist Gerben van Cleef demonstrated how rule breakers amass power. Scientists had already shown that powerful people are likelier than others to violate norms, as he wrote in his paper, to interrupt, to eat with their mouths open, to cheat, to lie in negotiations, to break traffic laws, to lack empathy, to treat others as objects, to ignore suffering and to sexually harass lower-status women. People who drop cigarette ash on the floor or put their feet on their desks are perceived by others as powerful because their defiant actions signal that they can seem to do what they want despite the constraints. Van Cleef hypothesized that social groups cede power to transgressors only when the transgression benefits them. In his experiments, he found that a man who helps himself uninvited to a stranger's coffee thermos amasses power when he shares the stolen coffee with others. If he steals the coffee and keeps it for himself, he does not. Scientists cannot study harmful norm violations, such as sexual aggression, Van Cleef wrote. Clearly, Epstein relished his transgressor role. He loved taking extreme, unpopular stances on political and cultural topics. He made arguments about gender roles, physical beauty, and intelligence from a social Darwinist view, making such comments as ugly is usually unhealthy, deformities signal disease. His friends seemed to credit him with intellectual honesty. You're a genius, wrote Martin Nowak, a mathematician at Harvard, repeatedly. Nowak did not respond to a request for comment. In an email exchange with Bach, the cognitive scientist, Epstein reflects inscrutably on eugenics, questions of innate abilities of women and black people, and seems to propose euthanasia of the elderly. I find your political incorrectness very fascinating, Bach responded. In the beginning, I thought it is a form of costly signaling, but now I think you are simply entirely unconstrained in your thoughts. How did you manage in your youth? In his interview in Die Zeit, Bach was asked whether he had doubts about Epstein, given his prior crimes. Bach said he did and consulted with a significant circle of eminent scientists. He said, everyone I talked to insisted that Epstein had changed his ways after his conviction and no longer broke any laws, and that he had done great services to science, despite his irrecoverable public reputation. Epstein's open misogyny seemed to enable others. The files show him discussing the size and shape of women's breasts with Tancredi Marchiolo, the London-based hedge fund manager. After Marchiolo had sex with someone he called Arizona Muse, he reached out to Epstein to discuss. A bit old, 25. The expletive looked like a 70-year-old sagging woman that had them reduced, Marchiolo wrote. Also, Marchiolo complained, she had a child. Once a woman has given birth, the party's over, he wrote in Italian. Marchiolo did not respond to a request for comment. Secrecy encircled all of this talk, a dynamic that Peter Attia, the longevity influencer, described in his recent apology for joining Epstein's misogynist banter. In 2016, Attia wrote a fawning email to Epstein. The life you lead is so outrageous and yet I cannot tell a soul, he wrote, while also joking that expletive is indeed low carb. Now he calls that message juvenile and defends himself as having been naive and sucked into a world that felt strange and exciting. He lived in the largest home in all of Manhattan, owned a Boeing 727, Attia wrote. I treated that access as something to be quiet about rather than discussed freely with others. The secrecy worked like glue, binding Epstein's associates closer to him, and Epstein himself enforced it. In emails to his powerful friends, which had threatening undertones, he alluded to shared confidences and referred to them as a mutual debt. He reprimanded women who left sex toys in full view and acquaintances for violating his code of decorum. When the global marketer Ian Osborne apparently made the mistake of reaching out directly to Mayor Michael Bloomberg's office to invite him to an Epstein-hosted event, Epstein reprimanded him. Unless necessary, I always prefer that the fewer people that know the better, so your email to his office people was concerning, he wrote. If Michael in any way feels awkward, tell me. I wholeheartedly regret that I ever met or had any association whatsoever with Epstein, Osborne said earlier this month. Secrets create a boundary between who's in and who's out, said Michael Slapian, a social psychologist at Columbia University, and they enhance insiders' sense of being chosen. A shared secret, Slapian continued, has a paradoxical effect. It actually makes it harder to hide, but it makes it easier to live with. The banality of so many of the emails is striking. Can't make 1 p.m., how about 1:30? Won't be in town after all. Flying to Paris, to the Caribbean, to Palm Beach. Here are the flight manifests, the tickets to Davos, the screening, the benefit. Here's the guest list, the menu. Mort Zuckerman is vegan. Sunyi Previn is on her way to Pilates. Sorry to cancel. Can we reschedule? Kurt Gray, a moral philosopher at Ohio State, described how people might find themselves complicit in unimaginable harm and collective silence. A focus on day-to-day details can serve to distance people from what's before them. I think they're just like, yeah, I'm going to do a little logistics. I'm going to get there. I need support for my research, from a hang with this guy who says interesting things. Then people find themselves at Epstein's dinner table, and you want to be a part of the group and be this easy dude on this island. You want to be included. You don't want to be rejected, Gray continues. And you're just not thinking about these women or how they got there or their plight or their humanity. It's this kind of myopia. Politics. U.S. kills 11 in boat strikes in Pacific and Caribbean. It was the first time in the campaign against people the United States accuses of drug smuggling at sea that American forces blew up boats on both sides of the Panama Canal in the same day. By Carol Rosenberg. American forces blew up three boats overnight, killing 11 men in strikes in both the Eastern Pacific Ocean and Caribbean Sea, the military announced on Tuesday. The strikes raised the death toll in the United States campaign against people it accuses of drug smuggling at sea to at least 144. The triple strike late Monday was the first time the Trump administration bombed targets on both sides of the Panama Canal on the same day in its five-month string of boat attacks. It was also the deadliest day of strikes this year. Of the 11 men killed, 8 were on the 2 boats in the Pacific and the other 3 were in the Caribbean, the military said. The United States Southern Command announced the strikes on social media with a 39-second video clip that appeared to show the 3 boats being destroyed. One was on the move, its outboard motors leaving a wake, while the other 2 appeared to be at full stop in the water. A broad range of legal specialists on the use of lethal force have said the strikes are illegal, extrajudicial killings, because the military cannot deliberately target civilians who do not pose an imminent threat of violence, even if they are suspected of engaging in criminal acts. The command, which oversees U.S. military operations in Latin America and the Caribbean, cited unspecified intelligence in its announcement. It said all 3 boats had been traveling on known narco-trafficking routes and were engaged in narco-trafficking operations. The attack suggested an uptick in the campaign. The military last killed 11 people in coordinated strikes on December 30th, when it attacked 3 boats that were traveling in a convoy in the Pacific. Those killed included 8 people who the military said jumped overboard before the second and third boats were hit, but were presumed dead after a search by the Coast Guard. The U.S. military has carried out strikes every 3 or 4 days since the new leader of the Southern Command, General Francis L. Donovan, took over last month after the previous leader, Admiral Alvin Halsey, abruptly retired. Defense officials said Admiral Halsey had expressed concerns about the strikes. Media. Colbert says CBS pulled Senate candidate interview. Stephen Colbert said he had to drop an interview with James Tallarico from his Monday broadcast because of new FCC guidance that targeted political interviews on late-night shows, by John Copeland. Stephen Colbert said on his late-night show on Monday that his network, CBS, barred him from airing an interview with a Democratic candidate for a U.S. Senate race because of new guidance from the Trump administration about equal airtime for political candidates. It's the first time that a late-night talk show has changed its programming to meet the demands of that update from the Federal Communications Commission, which has over the last year ramped up its efforts to crack down on the major media companies for perceived bias. Mr. Colbert, a frequent critic of President Trump, made it clear he did not make the change willingly. Over 6 minutes on Monday's edition of The Late Show, Mr. Colbert blasted Brendan Carr, the chairman of the FCC. And in a rebuke of CBS, Mr. Colbert said that the network would not have him on the broadcast, and because my network clearly does not want us to talk about this, let's talk about this. Mr. Colbert said that CBS lawyers had told him in no uncertain terms that an interview he had planned for Monday's show with State Representative James Tallarico of Texas would not air on the show, even though the lawmaker was already in Mr. Colbert's studio. Early voting began on Tuesday in the Texas primary election, where Mr. Tallarico is competing against Jasmine Crockett to be the state's Democratic nominee to run against Senator John Cornyn, a Republican. Mr. Colbert pointed to new guidance from the FCC from January, warning media companies that talk shows carried on local broadcast networks were required to offer equal airtime to candidates competing for the same office. CBS pushed back on Mr. Colbert's version of events on Tuesday, saying the network had not prohibited the interview from airing, but that it instead provided legal guidance that broadcasting the interview could trigger the FCC equal time rule. CBS said it then presented the show options for how the equal time for other candidates could be fulfilled. There has long been an exemption to the FCC's equal time rule for bona fide news programming, such as evening news programs. Media companies have long taken it as a given that late-night shows qualified for the same exemption, particularly after the FCC ruled in 2006 that interviews on The Tonight Show with Jay Leno were considered bona fide news. After the FCC issued its new guidance, Mr. Carr underscored that was no longer the case. For years, legacy TV networks assumed that their late-night and daytime talk shows qualify as bona fide news programs, even when motivated by purely partisan political purposes, he said on Axe last month. Today, the FCC reminded them of their obligation to provide all candidates with equal opportunities. Representatives for the FCC and Mr. Colbert declined to comment. Mr. Trump has repeatedly lashed out against many late-night hosts since he returned to the White House last year. Just this weekend, he insulted Bill Maher, the HBO talk show host, in a post on Truth Social. Mr. Carr has taken particular aim at late-night and daytime television shows that he believes are biased. Last year, ABC removed Jimmy Kimmel Live from its airwaves for almost a week after Mr. Carr suggested that the administration could punish the network because of remarks the late-night host had made in a monologue. Earlier this month, the FCC started a probe into ABC's The View because of an interview with Mr. Tallarico, Fox News reported. On Monday's show, Mr. Colbert repeatedly criticized Mr. Carr, at one point saying that he looked like a smug bowling pin and saying that he believed Mr. Carr was motivated by partisan purposes. "Let's just call this what it is," Mr. Colbert said. "Donald Trump's administration wants to silence anyone who says anything bad about Trump on TV because all Trump does is watch TV." Mr. Colbert went on to say that he and Mr. Kimmel were two of the people most affected by this threat because they had promptly criticized the new guidance when it was announced last month. Because the equal time provisions apply only to broadcast airwaves, Mr. Colbert announced his interview with Mr. Tallarico would be posted to his show's YouTube page, though he said that network lawyers told him not to give out a URL or a QR code to the link. That interview had more than 1.7 million views on YouTube early Tuesday afternoon, significantly more than the 93,000 views of a video of Mr. Colbert interviewing Jennifer Garner, who was also a guest on Monday's episode. The FCC's lone Democratic commissioner, Ana Gomez, said on Tuesday that CBS's refusal to air the interview was another troubling example of corporate capitulation in the face of this administration's broader campaign to censor and control speech. Mr. Colbert is in his final months hosting The Late Show, which will go off the air in May. CBS has said that the show's cancellation was purely a financial decision against a challenging backdrop in late night. But many have continued to speculate that the network removed the show for political reasons. CBS's parent company, Paramount, is also competing with Netflix to acquire Warner Brothers Discovery. Any deal would require the blessing of the federal government. Battle over Warner Brothers Discovery. Warner Brothers Discovery restarts deal talks with Paramount. Paramount's takeover bid was rejected in favor of Netflix, which wanted only the streaming and studio businesses. Paramount said it would pay more if negotiations were reopened, by Lauren Hirsch. Warner Brothers Discovery said on Tuesday that it would restart the deal talks with Paramount Skydance that it ended in December, giving the company another chance at besting Netflix for a deal. Paramount will have until February 23rd to negotiate its best and final offer. Warner Brothers Discovery last year rejected Paramount's offer to buy the entire company for $108 billion in favor of a deal to sell only its streaming and studio business to Netflix for $83 billion. Warner Brothers Discovery said at the time that Netflix offered the better deal for shareholders. Paramount disagreed and quickly made its case to shareholders through a hostile bid. In the roughly 2 months since then, Paramount has amended its offer twice, each time addressing some of the concerns that Warner Brothers Discovery's board had raised. Paramount's chief executive, David Ellison, has also raised questions about the Netflix bid, including whether its deal can pass regulatory scrutiny. Some Warner Brothers Discovery investors, including Pentwater Capital Management, have also raised concerns, encouraging the company to restart talks with Paramount. Shares of Warner Brothers Discovery and Paramount Skydance were both up about 3% in pre-market trading. To date, Paramount has not publicly raised its offer from $30 a share. But last week, Warner Brothers Discovery said that a senior representative for Paramount had verbally informed a company board member that if the board authorized talks with Paramount, it would agree to pay $31 a share. In that conversation, the Paramount representative added that it would be willing to further improve its offer. It's about time the actual headline price bidding heated up in what has to be one of the most inactive corporate bidding wars in history, Eric Talley, a business professor at Columbia Law School, said. In a letter to the Paramount board on Tuesday, David Zaslav, the chief executive of Warner Brothers Discovery, and Samuel A. DiPiazza, Jr., chairman of the company, said, "We welcome the opportunity to engage with you and expeditiously determine whether PSKY can deliver an actionable, binding proposal that provides superior value." In Paramount's latest offer, it agreed to pay the $2.8 billion fee Warner Brothers Discovery would owe to Netflix if their agreement were terminated, as well as agreeing to back Warner Brothers Discovery's debt costs. Paramount also said it would pay Warner Brothers Discovery's shareholders around $650 million in cash, starting in 2027, for each quarter that the deal did not close. Warner Brothers Discovery said Tuesday that it had requested a number of clarifications about Paramount's latest proposal. Among them were concerns about the extent of Paramount's support for Warner Brothers Discovery's debt costs and the conditions under which Paramount could legally walk away from the deal. It also wanted assurances that Paramount would be willing to contribute more equity if its debt financing fell apart. According to the terms of Warner Brothers Discovery's contract with Netflix, it can engage in talks with a rival bidder if it thinks it can lead to a reasonably superior offer. Warner Brothers Discovery said in its letter on Tuesday that it did not yet think the Paramount's offer met that bar, but that Netflix had given Warner Brothers Discovery a 7-day waiver to see if it could clarify its concerns. Throughout the robust and highly competitive strategic review process, Netflix has consistently taken a constructive, responsive approach with WBD, in stark contrast to Paramount Skydance, Netflix said in a statement released on Tuesday. "While we are confident that our transaction provides superior value and certainty, we recognize the ongoing distraction for WBD stockholders and the broader entertainment industry caused by PSKY's antics." On Tuesday, Paramount acknowledged Warner Brothers Discovery's decision, saying it had opted to secure a waiver rather than deeming Paramount's bid as one that could be reasonably expected to be superior. In doing so, Paramount said, Warner Brothers Discovery did not allow itself an unfettered right to negotiate without a time deadline. "Although the board's actions are unusual," Paramount said, "Paramount is nonetheless prepared to engage in good faith and constructive discussions." If Paramount makes a superior offer, Netflix has the right to improve its own bid. Shares of Netflix have been under pressure since it announced the deal in December, falling about 15% this year. Its stock rose 1.5% in pre-market trading. Discovery said on Tuesday that it had scheduled a shareholder vote on Netflix's offer for March 20th. NY Region. Pride flags removal from Stonewall violated federal law, suit says. The lawsuit, filed by a group of nonprofits, argues that the Trump administration's decision runs afoul of a law that allows national monuments to fly flags providing historical context. By Christopher Mogg. A group of nonprofits filed a lawsuit in federal court on Tuesday against the Trump administration, arguing that its decision to remove the Pride flag from the Stonewall National Monument in Manhattan this month violated a federal law that allows national parks and monuments to fly Confederate flags. The lawsuit, led by a foundation honoring Gilbert Baker, the artist who created the rainbow flag in 1978, seeks to restore the official Pride flag to the monument in Greenwich Village. The flag was removed from the monument's small, triangular park, the symbolic heart of the gay rights movement, apparently during the night of February 8th. Employees at the historic Stonewall Inn, the gay bar for which the monument is named, noticed the flag was missing when they arrived for work the next morning. Days later, hundreds of people gathered in the park on Christopher Street as elected officials replaced the flag. A pride flag was still flying there on Tuesday morning, but only the official flag that was removed is sanctioned by the National Park Service, meaning that any replacement flags can be taken down at any time, said Alexander Christofkok, a lawyer representing the Gilbert Baker Foundation in the lawsuit. It should not be a pirate act to raise the rainbow flag at the monument, said Andrew Berman, executive director of Village Preservation, one of the groups that filed the suit. When asked last week about its decision to remove the pride flag, the Park Service referred to a federal memo issued on January 21st, stating that, with some exceptions, only the U.S. flag and other flags authorized by Congress or the agency can be flown on flagpoles managed by the Park Service. In the lawsuit, the Gilbert Baker Foundation argued that the original pride flag fell under one of the allowed exceptions, to provide historical context at national monuments. This is the exception that allows Confederate flags to be flown at properties managed by the Park Service, including Gettysburg National Military Park. Whether flags and other monuments to the Confederacy should be allowed on federal land has long been the subject of heated debate. After a white supremacist murdered 9 black churchgoers in Charleston, South Carolina, in 2015, Congress passed legislation barring stores operated by the National Park Service on federal land from selling merchandise displaying standalone Confederate flags. The same year, the Park Service asked companies and nonprofits to stop selling Confederate flags on federal land, especially items that are wearable and displayable. In 2025, the Trump administration reinstalled a statue of a Confederate diplomat and general to the grounds of the U.S. Capitol. The statue had been toppled and set on fire in 2020 by Black Lives Matter protesters. The lawsuit on Tuesday was filed by the Gilbert Baker Foundation, Village Preservation, formerly the Greenwich Village Society for Historic Preservation, and Equality New York, an advocacy organization. It argues that the decision to remove the pride flag at Stonewall was not actually about following the law, but rather was part of an effort by the Trump administration to discriminate against the LGBTQ community. The Department of the Interior and the National Park Service did not respond to emails seeking comment on the suit. It's not just any park and it's not just any flag, said Karen Lowy, a lawyer for Lambda Legal, a civil rights group participating in the suit. It's hard not to view this removal in the broader context of the Trump administration's efforts to erase the existence of LGBTQ plus people and transgender people in particular. Last February, the National Park Service removed references to transgender people from sections of the Stonewall National Monument's website. In June, during Pride Month, Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth stripped the name of Harvey Milk, one of the country's first openly gay elected officials, from a U.S. Navy ship. In October, Kash Patel, the FBI director, fired an agent in training after he hung a pride flag near his desk. The Trump administration has broad powers to interpret federal rules, Mr. Christofak said. However, it must follow federal law when doing so, and any changes cannot be motivated by animus toward a particular group, he said. After so many decisions by the administration to strip the symbols and history of the gay rights movement from federal properties and agencies, the removal of the pride flag from the Stonewall Monument raises the inference that this is really targeted at the LGBTQ community, Mr. Christofak said. The Stonewall Inn on Christopher Street has long been seen as a cradle of the movement after a police raid there in June 1969 set off 3 days of protests and riots in the surrounding streets. Among the visitors to the Stonewall Monument on Tuesday was Ted Romero, who had arrived with a group of friends from the West Coast. We wanted to make sure the flag was still in place, Mr. Romero, 64, said, for this to happen is a slap in the face to all those who came before us. U.S. politics. Obama took on recession, health care, and Iraq. What he did not see coming was Trump. A new set of oral history interviews documents how Barack Obama and his advisors missed the shifting mood of the country that would ultimately replace him with a successor they considered a con man, clown, and laughingstock, by Peter Baker. As President Barack Obama's chief strategist, David Axelrod, made his way across a hotel ballroom on the night of the White House Correspondents Association dinner in 2011, he happened to overhear Donald J. Trump boasting to other guests. "I know it's crazy," Mr. Trump was saying, "but I'm in front of the polls." "I kind of chuckled at it and went to my seat," Mr. Axelrod recalled. "I don't think any of us really anticipated that Donald Trump would be a serious candidate for president, much less president." It was later that same evening that Mr. Obama would mock Mr. Trump from the stage, ridiculing the reality television star in a moment that would go viral. In fact, Mr. Obama and his team never saw Mr. Trump coming, as a new set of oral history interviews released on Tuesday makes abundantly clear. He was, to them, a con man, a clown, a laughingstock. He was a thorn in the side, with his birther lies and demagogic bloviating. But as it turned out, Mr. Obama and his advisors, like many others, missed the shifting mood of the country that would ultimately upend Mr. Axelrod's assumptions. The oral history compiled by Insight Institute, a social science research center at Columbia University, represents the most extensive set of interviews made public to date from the Obama presidency. The Institute, in cooperation with the Obama Foundation, conducted more than 450 interviews totaling more than 1,100 hours of audio and video with cabinet secretaries, White House aides, family members, opposition leaders, and outside figures affected by administration policies. Two limited tranches of the oral history interviews were released previously, but the Institute posted the full set online on Tuesday morning for the perusal of historians, researchers, and the merely curious. The interviews do not include Mr. Obama himself or his wife, Michelle Obama, or Vice President Joseph R. Biden Jr., but do include major figures like Hillary Clinton, John F. Kerry, Robert M. Gates, Paul D. Ryan, Oprah Winfrey, and even the former president's mother-in-law, Marian Robinson, who died in 2024. The interviews tell the backstory of a presidency that pulled the country out of the worst economic crisis since the Great Depression, rescued the auto industry, passed landmark legislation on health care, gay rights, and financial regulation, brought home most troops from Iraq, and hunted down and killed Osama bin Laden. They also explore the failure to stop the Russian annexation of Crimea, the slaughter in Syria, the collapse of Libya, and the rise of the Islamic State. But 9 years after he left office, with high approval ratings and 1 year into Mr. Trump's second term, what remains striking is how inconceivable it seemed to Mr. Obama and his team that populist disenchantment with the establishment, globalization, and demographic changes would elevate a figure they scorned. It was a question that hovered over the interviews as they struggled for answers. The outcome of the election was a direct rebuke of everything that we had been trying to do for the last 10 years, reflected Josh Earnest, who was Mr. Obama's last White House press secretary. Trump's candidacy, he added, the essence of his being and everything that he stood for and everything about the way that he carried himself and everything that he championed and his rhetoric, his campaign tactics, all were anathema to everything that the Obama campaign and the Obama era, the Obama administration, had been about. Mr. Axelrod recounted that the first time he ever spoke with Mr. Trump was in 2010, during the BP oil leak in the Gulf of Mexico. Mr. Trump reached out through Mika Brzezinski, one of the hosts of Morning Joe on MSNBC, to offer his services to plug the leak. Mr. Axelrod thought it was preposterous and politely declined. But when the spill was finally halted, Mr. Trump had another idea for Mr. Axelrod. "I build ballrooms. I build the greatest. You can ask anybody. My ballrooms are the greatest ballrooms," Mr. Trump told him by phone, as Mr. Axelrod recalled. "You have these state dinners, and you have them in these expletive little tents out in the backyard. Let me build a modular ballroom that you can assemble when you have state dinners, so it'll look good." Mr. Axelrod thought that would be a bad signal in the midst of this monstrous recession and brushed him off. "I said, well, that's really nice of you. I'm going to pass this on to the social secretary and I'll have her call you," Mr. Axelrod recalled. "I did. She did not. Nearly a decade later, Mr. Trump is now finally building his ballroom. The decision to roast Mr. Trump at the 2011 Correspondents' Dinner stemmed from aggravation over the continuing lies about Mr. Obama's birthplace. "I thought what he was doing was racist," recalled Jon Favreau, the speechwriter who helped draft the remarks. "I thought, and still do think, that he is a ridiculous human being who deserves to be ridiculed at every possible chance." Mr. Favreau and his colleagues came up with lines making fun of Mr. Trump's Celebrity Apprentice television show. "We gave it to Obama and he loved it," Mr. Favreau said. "He was so excited to do it." Did Mr. Favreau think at the time that Mr. Trump might be a formidable presidential candidate? Not even a brief moment did I ever think that. At the dinner, Mr. Favreau said Mr. Trump approached Seth Meyers, the late-night comic who performed that night and also made fun of Mr. Trump. He told Seth, "That was very unfair, what you did. It was very unfair." At the after-party, Mr. Favreau said, he and Mr. Meyers laughed at Mr. Trump. We were like, wow, we really got him. There are those who speculate that Mr. Trump's red-faced fury that evening may have played a part in motivating him to run for president. He kicked off his campaign 4 years later in June 2015. "Nobody took it seriously at the time," said Cody Keenan, another speechwriter for Mr. Obama. Indeed, after Mr. Trump proposed banning Muslims from entering the United States, Mr. Ernest dismissed the Republican candidate from the White House lectern. "I talked about Donald Trump and his ideas being relegated to the dustbin of history," Mr. Ernest recalled. "I think I was kind of wrong about that, unfortunately." Mr. Trump surged to the Republican nomination despite the Obama team's expectations, but even then they assumed he could not beat Mrs. Clinton in the general election. Mr. Obama wanted to give a speech at the Democratic National Convention, pushing back against the forces that Mr. Trump represented. "At the time, I don't think anybody thought Donald Trump was going to win," Mr. Keenan said. "So it was not aimed at him, and that's because his party is the party that made it happen. None of this began with Donald Trump. These were trends that have been happening for a long time, stoking fear of the others, stoking misinformation, kind of this phony populism that turned people against each other. While more voters cast ballots for Mrs. Clinton, making her the popular vote winner, the Electoral College lined up for Mr. Trump, making him the president-elect. The White House was a dark place in the days that followed. There's a pall over everything because you have no idea what the Trump stuff is going to be, and everything feels at risk," said Dennis McDonough, the last White House chief of staff for Mr. Obama. "I feel like we accomplished what we set to accomplish, except Trump won." The day after the election, Mr. Obama called distraught aides to the Oval Office to comfort them. "History does not move in a straight line," he told them, and encouraged them to be proud of what they had accomplished. What struck me in those days after Trump won was even in the midst of that how steady he was, Mr. Favreau said. "I expected to find him depressed, alarmed, panicked. None of that." But there were some moments when the normally stoic Mr. Obama revealed his own emotions. He came to speak to the senior staff, recalled Christy Goldfuss, the managing director of the White House Council on Environmental Quality. He got up to give a speech, and he started crying, and he thanked everybody, and he thanks all of us for believing in him. He was not the only one with moist eyes. Jen Psaki, who was Mr. Obama's communications director, recalled that even figures like Jacob L. Lew, the Treasury Secretary, and Susan Rice, the National Security Advisor, all these people who are so tough and smart and complete badasses, were tearing up at points. In those moments, and plenty since, it was hard for Mr. Obama's team not to wonder what it all meant. It's like, was that a success? Ms. Psaki reflected. I don't know, but it is a piece of history which is important. Politics. House Republican faces backlash to Islamophobic post. Representative Randy Fine had responded to a Palestinian organizer by saying that the choice between dogs and Muslims is not a difficult one. By Annie Carney. Representative Randy Fine, Republican of Florida, on Tuesday, faced a barrage of calls for his resignation from Democrats and silence from Republican leaders after making an Islamophobic statement suggesting he prefers dogs to Muslims. Mr. Fine, a Jewish first-term congressman who was known in the Florida legislature as the Hebrew Hammer and often makes Islamophobic remarks on social media, made the statement in question on Sunday in response to a post from a Palestinian activist based in New York City. Nurdin Kiswani, a Palestinian Muslim New Yorker and organizer, said in a social media post that dung-filled snowdrifts in the city proved that dogs should not have a place in society as indoor pets because, she wrote, like we've said all along, they are unclean. Mr. Fine responded, if they force us to choose, the choice between dogs and Muslims is not a difficult one. The comment prompted immediate and unequivocal condemnation from Democrats. Representative Hakeem Jeffries, Democrat of New York and the minority leader, said that Mr. Fine is a disgrace to the United States Congress. He is an Islamophobic, disgusting, and unrepentant bigot. Mr. Jeffries added that it was unacceptable that Mike Johnson and House Republicans continue to remain silent, referring to the Speaker. Governor Gavin Newsom of California, the reigning Democratic king of trolling Republicans online, wrote bluntly, "Resign now, you racist slob." Many House Democrats called for Mr. Fine to be stripped of his committee assignments, but Mr. Johnson remained silent, and Mr. Fine doubled down in response to the backlash. "My post was in response to a major Muslim leader saying dogs should be forbidden from New York City because to some Muslims it bothers them," Mr. Fine said in an appearance on Newsmax. "If they are going to make us choose between our dogs and them going home, the choice is easy." On social media, Ms. Kiswani called Mr. Fine a rabid Zionist who used her words as an excuse to post genocidal rhetoric against Muslims. In a follow-up email to the New York Times, Ms. Kiswani said that she had intended her words to land as a mild, satirical post and viewed Mr. Fine's response as reflective of a political climate in which anti-Palestinian and anti-Muslim bigotry is normalized and hostility toward our communities is more easily justified. She said her post was misinterpreted and used as grounds for days of attacks, threats, and widespread misinformation, including inaccurate claims that I am a part of Mayor Mamdani's administration. Mr. Fine has referred to both Muslim women in Congress as terrorists. In a post in May, he addressed Representative Rashida Tlaib, Democrat of Michigan, who had accused the Israeli government of starving Gazans, saying she should tell your fellow Muslim terrorists to release the hostages and surrender. Until then, hashtag starve away. In July, Mr. Fine called Representative Ilhan Omar, Democrat of Minnesota, a terrorist after she appeared to refer to Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu of Israel as a war criminal. "I am sure it is difficult to see us welcome the killer of so many of your fellow Muslim terrorists," he wrote online, referring to Ms. Omar. "The only shame is that you serve in Congress." At the time, House Democratic leaders condemned his comment. Mr. Johnson never did. World. Palmerston, the former chief mouser for Britain's Foreign Office, dies. The cat, who was named after a former prime minister, became a social media star. By the time of his death at about 12, he had more followers than many ambassadors have. By Amelia Nirenberg. Palmerston, a cat who served as the chief mouser for Britain's diplomatic service, has died in Bermuda. He was about 12. Palmerston, diplocat extraordinaire, passed away peacefully, his social media account announced on Friday, a day after he died. "He was a wonderful companion with a gentle nature and will be sorely missed. Farewell, Palmerston, with love and thanks," the Foreign Office wrote in a separate tribute on social media, acknowledging his work as a feline diplomat. Palmerston was born in 2013, according to the Foreign Office, and was named after Lord Palmerston, the 19th century Foreign Secretary and two-time Prime Minister. The cat was adopted in 2016 from the Battersea Cats and Dogs Home, an animal rescue center in London, after he had spent a rough time on the streets. "He was hungry, underweight, and had no microchip," the BBC reported. "He was initially tasked with dealing with mice in the Foreign Office's Victorian-era headquarters in London, one of the British government's grandest buildings. But he became a social media star, eventually amassing almost 100,000 followers on X, more than many British ambassadors have. He even dressed for the part. Famously, he never took off his tuxedo. A few months after Palmerston was adopted, Britain voted to leave the European Union, a decision that led to a period of political turmoil. On the ground, Palmerston kept calm and carried on catching mice. On social media, he was a friendly face for the country through his regular updates. During the coronavirus pandemic, Palmerston was eventually moved out of central London and formally retired to the countryside in 2020 with Andrew Murdoch, who worked in the Foreign Office alongside the cat. In Palmerston's farewell letter to Simon MacDonald, then the top civil servant at the Foreign Office, Palmerston revealed himself to be a master diplomat or even spy by admitting to pretending to be asleep while overhearing all the foreign dignitaries' conversations. Last February, Palmerston wrote on X that he had come out of retirement to take up a new posting as a feline relations consultant in Bermuda with Mr. Murdoch. It was a good gig for an aging cat. Palmerston described his work as feline relations consultant, semi-retired. There he gave audiences to visitors between well-deserved naps, the office of the governor said on social media. Many will miss him, but perhaps no one understood him better than Larry the Cat, the chief mouser at No. 10 Downing Street, the Prime Minister's official residence, who has almost 900,000 followers on social media. At first, the two did not get along. Video footage taken soon after Palmerston arrived at the Foreign Office showed the cats in the sort of heated confrontation more commonly seen between politicians than civil servants. Larry was once spotted with a limp after reports that Palmerston had clawed him. But the two appeared to have repaired their relationship after Palmerston moved out of London. Last week, Larry joined the nation in mourning his old rival after a life of service for Queen, King, and country. Farewell, old friend, he wrote on social media. This concludes the presentation of The New York Times for Wednesday, February 18th, 2026. My name is Elizabeth Ingber with the Talking Information Center. As always, thank you.